Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Anne Harrington is with me, Bill Russell, and the three of us are talking about the origins of the mind-body conversation. Bill, you've been listening intently.
Paula was surprised, I think, by the history piece. Once I understood you were a historian and what you were writing about, it seemed screamingly obvious because context is so important. And what you do is contextualize all these ideas rather than treat them in abstraction. And so much of what you're writing about is the contextualization of the human mind and of the human body. And I think particularly of, you mentioned Francisco Varela, who wrote something some time ago called The Embodied Mind, which got my attention in a big way. And it really sort of, you know, it's I think to me was a predicate for the work you're doing, which is contextualizing it in a historical sense in terms of the various personalities involved and in terms of these narratives that have been developed over time that seem to be, those narratives themselves seem as much as anything to be a product of the context in which they're developed.
Yes. Another thing that why I think the contextualization is powerful is that it helps you understand, at least to a large extent, why there's so much energy, why there's so much passion, what's at stake. I mean, one of the most powerful things I think history can help you understand is what's at stake in scientific ideas. The comfortable idea that science just, you know, will tell you things about the world and it doesn't particularly have any emotional valence to it, I think is very much belied by going back and seeing that where ideas come from, what the debates and passions around them have been from the beginning, and then how these, in a sense, have become almost black boxed inside the ideas. Coming back to the stories, people know these stories when they hear about stress and the whole thing about we suffer under burdens that are unique to the modern world. We need to be saved from ourselves. We're interested, even for Francisco Varela and his own quest, we need to turn to traditions that maybe know things that we in the benighted West, in our modernist, ignorant, narrow-minded kinds of pursuit of the wrong things, have lost sight of. And so we're going to reach out and claim from these ancient traditions things that might heal us. There's a narrative, implicit narrative framework that drives the kinds of decisions that people make, the kinds of moves that scientists make, the kinds of moves that patients make when they choose to go to one kind of clinician versus another. And you can't understand why people do what they do well, I think. You can't understand it simply by asking them, usually. Like, why do you, well, you know, because these things, we breathe these stories. They're part of the atmosphere. They're like the weather, and we don't necessarily know easily how to articulate them. But when you can step back and see how they move through time and how they then settle around us, like an atmosphere that we then inhale, it becomes easier to understand.
Well, and it's the data itself is contextualized. That to me is as surprising as anything. The scientific research is done, but it's done in a context, and the way that data is understood, is interpreted, and the theories that are built on that all seem to come from that context.
That surprised you? What would be an example of one particular piece of data that surprised you? And we can maybe talk more about that one.
Well, it wasn't so much the surprise. It's that ongoing flow of it's almost a dialectic between the context and the data, and they drive one another. There's a prevailing theory. Mesmer comes to mind.
Right. As in mesmerize. Right.
Most people tend to use mesmerize and hypnosis interchangeably. Well, turns out, as you point out so elegantly, ain't the case. That it's a much more interesting flow, and it is a flow.
And it's not that just he's a charlotan of some kind.
No, in fact, he was an Enlightenment scientist by the understanding of his, by the lights of his contemporaries.
Well, and it's that contextualization. I think that's the part that I find interesting.
I mean, I think the contextualization is best when it really does knock you a little bit off balance. When it surprises or destabilizes your easy assumptions. And that is why I think history can be powerful. But it's important to stress that, to say that the contextualization is not the same as debunking. It's not to say that because we can make sense of why a Francisco Varela, say, was interested in reaching out of the Western scientific tradition in which he was trained to Tibetan Buddhism, that therefore, and we can understand this, say, in the context of 1970s discontents with medicine and with the reductionistic impulses in science and the rise of a certain kind of Orientalist belief that says the East is the antipode to the West, and if we bring everything together, we'll be able to create a whole science and in that way also become whole ourselves. Just because you can do interesting work like that is not the same as saying that within the framework of different narratives, of different stories, that exciting things can't happen. In fact, I don't see how you could do science if you didn't have an orienting frame or story that would tell you what might be interesting to ask. The nature doesn't tell you what's interesting about it.
Well, from a spectator's perspective, it's the difference between stupid stereotypes, almost comic strips, and a richer, more nuanced understanding. And it's that nuanced understanding that begins to look like it may be applicable to our real lives, which are always much more complicated than the comic strips other people inhabit.
Yeah, science becomes much more human. And in a way, you can have, at least for me, you know, more compassion for the scientists as you see how embedded they are in the same world that all of us are in.
Well, and there's a temptation to think, well, we're doing it right now, and those people back then who didn't know what we know, they were wrong. And
right.
And this very, forgive my using the word, bipolar sense of right and wrong, and anything that we think is the right thing because it's now, and we're smarter than they were. And that I think actually surprised me as you unfolded the story about the times in which people lived and knew a great deal about themselves and their own situation. They saw it radically differently in no small measure because of the stories.
And it was persuasive, and it also, to some extent, was self-fulfilling because the data then, to a certain extent, now coming back particularly to this question about how far our bodies sometimes participate in the storytelling acts, the bodies, to a certain extent, believed the stories also. One of the reasons, and therefore the data to a certain important extent confirmed the narratives, and so we had a situation in which it was obvious that
and it was
nature
true.
It was true. One of the reasons that I became interested in the placebo effect was because it was clear to me that this was one of the most powerful ways of beginning to try to investigate, not only historically, but you know, in a broader way, some of the ways in which the bodies play along with the stories that we tell ourselves about what will make us well and what will make us sick.
And that sort of goes to the center of you mentioned, you used a word which escapes me right now, but it brought me to the work, a lot of work that is being done, particularly with Buddhism and particularly with Tibetan Buddhism, and the effects of the mind on the body and the body on the mind. And in some ways, your work on the placebo is a wonderful predicate for that, because it lays out some of the challenges of what we think of as real and what we think of as unreal, what we think of as somatic and what we think of as psycho.
Yeah, the placebo effect is a very uncomfortable phenomenon for scientists, even though we're currently in a phase in its history where we're kind of happy to romance it a little bit and happy to say, well, we actually think it's real, and then we will put people who have taken placebo morphine in fMRI machines and look, their brains are lighting up and things are happening. And even though that's going on historically and in some sense on some deep level even still today, if calling something a consequence of the placebo effect is the same as saying that it's not real. And in that sense, no one wants their science to be explained in terms of the placebo effect, not alternative medical doctors. Sometimes people have said that, you know, we, you know, should study alternative medicine and the placebo effect will be very helpful. They don't want to touch the placebo effect because it's the way of saying that it's all in your head. And this comes back to a real tension or ambiguity in the whole mind-body medicine endeavor that we haven't really touched on, which is that to a certain extent, You know, it's patients like it only when they like it. And when you come back to them and say, well, I think there's a psychosomatic explanation for this chronic pain you've been having, they're very insulted.
Psychosomatic makes it sound like it's all in your head and it's not real.
It's not real. So the another bizarre strand that needs, you know, or instability running through this is the way in which we do, at the same time as we're interested in how the mind affects the body, we're also very worried about the extent to which the mind can trick the body. And that instability that, you know, dominates through the history and into our own time, and nowhere more clearly probably than with concerns about the placebo effect.
And I think part of the challenge is, at least in my thinking, we tend to treat this as a linear process that ratchets. You know, we learn something, and that's a fact, and then we build on that, and we learn something and learn something. And it's, you know, it's sort of like a multidimensional ping pong game in a way, it seems. And again, the stories make that. It is not only the science, it is the people who are practicing the science, and it is the people who are practicing the science in the context in which they live.
It is
that of which Anne Harrington speaks. I want to interrupt so I don't have to interrupt more broadly. And when we come back, let us also talk about that third leg of that stool, that the body affects the mind as well as the mind and the body. So that and a number of other interesting things when we return in a moment. With Anne Harrington here on The Paula Gordon Show, Bill Russell and I, Paula, invite you to be with us when we return.